Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
If you passed out or if you threw up or something happened, we would just be like, you're not a drink champ.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 196, a talk with DJ EFN. EFN has done it all in hip-hop. Hosted mixtapes, put out albums, managed acts, owned a clothing store, run a marketing company, been on the radio, and more. If you're curious about his whole history, including his superb 2015 album Another Time, check our first interview with him on episode 102. But now, there are two major projects that have vaulted EFN into the spotlight. First, there's his Coming Home documentary series, where he travels around the world and discovers different countries through the lens of their hip-hop scene. The newest edition in the series, Coming Home Vietnam, premiered on Revolt TV last month. Second, EFN created and co-hosts with Nori the wildly popular Drink Champs podcast. The show has wild, booze-fueled conversations with hip-hop's elite, including Diddy, 50 Cent, Ice-T, and dozens of others. We spoke to DJ EFN via Skype from his home in Miami. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's someone who can tell you that transparent means you can see right through it, DJ EFN. Thanks for coming back.
Thank you for having me back.
Of course. You know, for people listening, people wanting to know DJ EFN's backstory, you know, how you became the mixtape king of Miami and your interactions with Pitbull and Rick Ross and stuff about your album Another Time. That's all covered on the first interview we did with you, which people should definitely check out.
Very thorough interview, I must say.
Thank you. But, you know, we want to get into a bunch of stuff, including Coming Home Vietnam, the new film in the Coming Home series, just premiered on Revolt. First, really want to ask the important, serious journalistic questions that, you know, people really want to know. What the hell does Tiger Bone actually taste like?
We're going to do this Tiger Bone shot together. Orlando, you the camera guy. I'm not even going to pull out my camera for 57app.com. I really want you to look at everybody's faces.
Oh, that's what I'm waiting for.
No. We don't go. We want to do this together as a team. I brought this for the whole crew as a team, so
if
I'm not
this shit
doing
makes
it.
Me go, rah, I'm going to get pissed, man.
I thought you were going to ask me if Dwight asked.
You know what he asked?
Yeah.
You know what he asked?
Nah.
I think you kind of admitted to it, huh?
I'm a Libra. I turned up.
Listen, you got to eat ass.
Tiger Bone is horrendous. It is, if you go back to the original recordings of the first XM show that me and Nori had together called Militainment Crazy Raw Radio, that we have some YouTube clips up. It looked and sounded like Drink Champs, basically.
Hey, it's your boy N-O-R-E. What up, it's DJ EFN. And it's Militainment Crazy Raw Radio, chilling with Hazardous Sounds, DJ KNS. Make some motherfucking noise!
And you know, we make some noise, we do the same introduction, and we drink Tiger Bone. And you can actually see a clip of me taking Tiger Bone in that, and you will see the face of horror.
You had a very descriptive phrase, too, talking about it.
That's like dirty licorice stuck up some fucking bear's asshole, man. Oh, fuck me, man. Who killed a tiger and made this crap, man? Holy tiger shit.
Okay, so you saw the clip. I'd say it's like dusty soy sauce. You know, I don't know. It's really bad. And I remember I did the research. I actually edited that little video clip that you see on YouTube back then, and I went and researched Tiger Bone because I wanted to make sure we really weren't drinking tiger blood and bones, which it tastes like you are drinking that mixed with a little ginger. So I found out that the original Tiger Bone, the original elixir, was actually you know, meshed up bone with some blood of the tigers, because, you know, the Chinese felt that had some healing and magical properties. But thankfully, by the time it got to us here in the United States, they obviously banned that, you know, the killing of tigers for that. And what we drink now is an herbal concoction.
Right, which ostensibly is not supposed to be a wine or liquor, right? It's supposed to be kind of like an herbal tonic for unspecified health ailments.
Instead of unspecified health ailments, Sean should have said it's basically intended as Viagra booze.
Right, at least isn't that the sort of cover story?
It's considered a wine just because of the fact that it's fermented.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah.
So we had you on here spring 2015, and about, you know, 11 months or a year later, Drink Champs pops up. So, you know, we wanted to know, what was it about your appearance on the Cypher that inspired you to create Drink Champs?
Yes, you guys inspired it all. Actually, do you want to know the comprehensive story of the journey that became Drink Champs?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, like I mentioned, we had that show on XM before the merger, then Sirius XM. It was Militainment Crazy Raw Radio. Then it was Crazy Militainment Radio. I don't know. We had a couple different evolutions of the name. We were on 66 Raw on XM. Then we were on Hip Hop Nation after the merger. And then we were on Backspin. And we really just, I really enjoyed doing that show. And it was just us with friends drinking, talking crap. And just something that we just did for fun, for promotion. And around that time, Nori and Pong got back together, I think, to record, to put out, I believe it was the Channel 10 CNN album.
Yep.
If I'm not wrong. And then they went and toured it in Europe. And in doing so, you know, him touring Europe, and then that's when I was starting to do a lot of stuff with Mayday, as I managed Mayday. We just didn't have time to do the show anymore. And when we stopped doing the show, I immediately started to think about ways that we can come back to doing something similar, but something that was more convenient to our schedules. And I had always had a friend that was in the podcast world, a friend by the name of Godfrey, who does Gamertag Radio. And he was always, you know, he's a big advocate for podcasting. It seems like podcasters, you know, as you guys would know, you guys, you know, just advocate for people to do podcasting. And so he's always telling me to maybe, you know, think of doing that, you know, with Nori or doing it on my own. And then, you know, someone had mentioned it to Nori. I believe it was the people from Loudspeakers Network, if I'm not wrong. The guys who do Combat Jack and all that. They had kind of mentioned to Nori about bringing back our old XM radio show as a podcast. And then Nori quickly referred them to me. And I had already been thinking of it. So we started to throw around that idea. But Nori wasn't ready for it yet. He really didn't understand what the whole podcast thing was about. He didn't get it. He didn't see it. So that was probably maybe 3 to 4, probably like 3 years before we launched Drink Champs and kind of deaded the idea or tabled it for a while. And then we came back to the idea when Nori did Tax Stone. He was on the Tax Stone show and Jay-Z called him off of that.
I always wanted to know, man, Is it true that pun story hitting Jay with the bottle?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It was, you know, the crazy shit, it was Tata and Flex, God bless the dead. Mm-hmm. Flex, not Funkmaster Flex, but Flex, Fat Joe's old manager. Mm-hmm. But don't get it twisted. And this might hurt a lot of people's feelings. Rockefeller niggas was hitting niggas in the head with bottles too.
Yeah.
Them niggas was.
And mind you, I had consistently been telling Nori, you know, let's try to get back on trying to do this podcast. But once he saw that Jay-Z called him off of a podcast appearance, he saw the power of podcast.
Day after Thanksgiving, got a call from Jay-Z. Said he wanted to build by something I said. Perhaps I was misled. Agree with Tax One story. Fuck it, it's still an honor. He still listened to Nori. I correct it cause I want to be useful. See, I correct it cause I want to be truthful. I can't front that's a moment.
And he was back on wanting to do it. And I had already for the longest, going back to the XM show when we were doing studio sessions at my studio, because we recorded that show in my studio. And sorry if I'm jumping around, but that's how my brain is. But I had back then we were throwing around this name called, you know, Drink Champs. It was just something that we said to each other because we were such heavy drinkers.
You didn't think, oh, this is going to be the name of something. It was just kind of a catchphrase that you used describing each other.
Right. So it was something we would throw around in the studio because, you know, we would just, you know, be drinking while we're recording and just we're heavy drinkers over here on this side. Nothing to be proud about, but it's just what we do. And we were, you know, if you passed out or if you threw up or something happened, we would just be like, you're not a drink champ. It was like an inside joke we had at Crazy Hood Studios. And I just loved the way that sounded. So going back maybe 5 years before Drink Champs, maybe even longer, I had grabbed the social media on it, you know, the Twitter, the Instagram. I had gotten the website, drinkchamps.com, and started working on a logo for it, and not even knowing that it would be a podcast. And then it was right when we got serious about doing the podcast that I told Nori, I think we should call it Drink Champs, and Drink Champs was born.
And so what was the original idea for the show? Because it feels like if you listen to the early episodes, you guys talk about, oh, we were going to have a sports guy and a music guy on an episode, but that didn't work out.
We got our first hip hop legendary guest. Our first guest because we had a basketball player, but now we got...
So two legends in a row.
We only do our legends. No new niggas can come on here. No. You got to pay your dues.
And I don't think you ever actually ran the interview you did with an NBA player. Was sports originally going to play a bigger part in it?
Well, we did end up running that episode. It was with Kenny Anderson. He was actually the first person that we did a Drink Champs episode with.
We're going to get into this NBA basketball edition, Left Rack City Zone.
Let's remind everybody that he's actually our first guest. We've been holding on to this.
Pause. He let us experiment on him. You know what I mean? So we're going to get into this. Like I said, you know, for the sports pack, NBA, Kenny Anderson, NYC legendary point guard. He's from Left Rack City, Queens, New York, just like me. And we're going to get into this episode, man. Let's get into it.
They wound up releasing this as episode 18.
But we ended up releasing the second episode we recorded, which was Fat Joe, as the first. We wanted to interview anybody we were interested in. I mean, first and foremost would be hip-hop artists and mostly artists from our generation, our era. And then, you know, athletes. You know, for myself, I'm really interested in bringing in people from, like, you know, actors and comedians and just really anybody, but the common denominator was always going to be, even like it was during the Sirius XM show days, is that we would have, you know, drinks and have like a real, just organic conversation, not a straightforward interview, just, you know, barbershop talk and just not have it feel like your typical interview.
Okay. And so with the satellite show, guests were not as much of a focus, right? What made you decide to kind of go in that direction of every show or almost every show is going to have an interview as sort of the central focus?
Well, the reason why we didn't have as many guests then is because we were recording out of my studio in South Miami. So logistically, not that many people could make it down to our studio. It wasn't very convenient for them. We did have a couple guests. I believe Ross was on our SiriusX show.
Here's some clips from my exclusive interview. Yo, what can we expect from the album, dog?
Just expect the best music. I've been making my whole career. You know what I'm saying? I'm putting it all on the line. It's all authentic. You know, Lil Wayne on the album, Kanye, Robin.
I think Fat Joe, maybe even Scott Storch. We had a couple, but yeah, it was mainly focused around, you know, our friends. When we did the podcast, we definitely wanted to get more serious about it. We knew that there was a potential to make some decent revenue off of it. So we just decided we just wanted to have a little bit more star power in terms of just, you know, some known people being interviewed and on the show. So that's just the reason why we went that route.
Cool. And we'll definitely hit some more crazy moments that have happened during the year you guys have been on the air in a minute. But I wanted to talk about Coming Home Vietnam, which is the latest entry in your series of Coming Home films, a kind of travelogue of hip hop culture around the world. One of the things that was most fascinating about the film to me is very early on, you talk to people and you say, hey, when did hip hop in Vietnam start? And not only do they have, you know, an approximate answer, they have a specific year and a specific group of people who, you know, oh, they studied in another country and then they came back and brought hip hop to Vietnam. And they can pinpoint 92 was a crew with this name.
Like, when do you think hip hop started getting its roots in Vietnam? Like, how long ago?
I think hip hop starting in Vietnam in 1992.
Okay.
20 years ago, they make a crew named Big Toe Crew. I have some student, they study in another country like France or USA. They go back to Vietnam, they bring hip hop to Vietnam.
Which was kind of wild to me. What were your thoughts about that, about the specificity of them being able to say it started here with these people?
It didn't really surprise me the time frame that they're talking, because in my journeys, I feel like more or less that time frame is what like really resonated with people. But one of the things that we might not know, and I should have maybe dove into it, is maybe something happened politically around those years with our relationship in terms of the West and Vietnam. Because, you know, we did fight a war with Vietnam, not just us, the French, you know, so basically it's like the West and Vietnam. And there probably was a break in the politics and relationships that might have made it easier for information or travel or, you know, something of that nature that happened. That's actually, now that you say that, it's something I'm going to research so that I, you know, maybe we can pinpoint it to that reason, you know, that something happening politically at that time.
In fact, the U.S. trade embargo on Vietnam was lifted on February 3rd, 1994 by then-President Bill Clinton.
Yeah, and you went in thinking, not unreasonably, that b-boying, that dance would be kind of the strongest element of the culture.
Right.
Did that hold up?
Yes, it did hold up. It not only did it hold up, well, it held up, but it also, I was surprised at the reasoning behind it, which was such a common sense reason why b-boying and breakdancing is such a prevalent thing in Asia and maybe in other countries as well versus other elements of hip-hop. They explained that the reason for it is that when hip-hop did arrive, they didn't understand the lyrics. So the first thing that they gravitated to was the moving to the beats, to the music itself, and how they can express themselves in a hip hop way to the music, and that was through b-boying and breakdancing. And so that made so much sense to me. And I was like, why did I not think of that being the obvious reason why they would be, you know, so much into the dancing element?
Makes sense. And you brought one of your friends along who is a graffiti artist, and you kind of discovered that the laws around graffiti in Vietnam are a little more ambiguous than here, a little more lenient than here. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, they don't, in terms of laws, they don't know what to make of graffiti yet. They can't, you know, they don't know if it's good or bad, so they kind of are indifferent to it. They look at it as, oh, those are nice colors on the wall, or I guess these kids are doing something with themselves. So yeah, they really don't bother. And we did a, in the film, we do this mural. We did two of them. We did one in Hanoi, which Hanoi is a lot more conservative because of the history of Vietnam. It was the capital. It is the capital now, but it was the capital during the war of the communists. So it is a more of a conservative city still to this day. And we did a mural in broad daylight in the middle of a neighborhood, and nobody said anything. In fact, there was, you know, some elderly people or some pedestrians walking by, they would just sit down and just watch it like they were watching a live art exhibition.
Awesome. And, you know, part of what drew you to Vietnam, obviously, it was your father, who was a Marine and stationed in Khe Sanh. Going in and going to Vietnam, you know, attempting to visit his base, what did you expect making that journey? What did you expect to find? What did you expect to feel? And kind of how did the actual experience match up?
That was very personal for me, just because my father and the war and my parents and them eventually getting divorced and being separated when I was very young, just that whole personal side to me, I was just very connected to Vietnam as a child, because I used the war as a way to connect with my father when he wasn't around. And you know, I was just like that little G.I. Joe kid that just, I was into everything war, into everything Vietnam. I loved all the movies. I loved all the TV shows. I reenacted things. You know, I thought I was in the war. it was just such a big part of my life. Like, you would have thought that I had been there already. But never in a million years, as a child at least, would I have ever thought that I would actually go to Vietnam, little less go to the grounds where my father, you know, and many other Marines fought fierce battles on. And it just landing in Vietnam was a huge emotional thing. By the time I got to the base, though, because the base is in such a remote area, it's in the mountains and it's in the middle of the country. It's kind of close to the Cambodian border. By the time, you know, it was such a long trek. So by the time we got there, I think I was just out of all, you know, I had already gone through all the mental exercises and thought processes and all of that. And so once I was on the base, it was more like just taking it in. So it was less emotion and more just being there and just, I don't know, just taking it all in.
I grew up obsessed with this place because I think, like many veterans, I believe that this took a toll on my dad's, you know, just his overall health, mental health, everything. And I can't pinpoint for sure that this is any particular reason why there was a breakup in the family. But you know, he was out of my life and for most of my young life. And in my head, I replaced it with trying to learn about him through the war. The war became very important to me, so I learned a lot about it because it was a big part of his life. And just by the fact that he gave me everything and didn't want anything else to do with it, obviously it was a big impact for him as well. It's just real, to me, it's surreal to be here, and I don't know, I'm just, you know, a lot of stuff happened around here, man.
But it was a huge thing for me. It was a huge big deal for me.
I believe it. Is your dad still around?
He's still around. We have a very strange relationship to this day. He suffers a lot from a lot of the injuries and you know, PTSD and all that from the war. He has he's 2 Purple Hearts. They've given him full benefits. He's like, I think they consider him handicapped and all that. So, but you know, I talk to him on the phone every so often, but unfortunately we don't really see each other, which
yeah.
I use the movie and hoping to still use this film to reconnect us in person.
Is he aware you made the trip as far as you know?
Yeah. I invited him to the premiere. He didn't make it, but, I sent him the film and he watched it. He said he enjoyed it. So yeah, hopefully, man, you know, we get to see each other soon. The real sad part about it is, he actually lives like literally like 3 miles away from me.
Yeah. I definitely know those kinds of situations. One thing that I've seen common in veterans and I guess specifically in Vietnam vets, just because that's the generation of people who are our parents' age,
right.
They don't really talk about their experiences over there. Was that the case with your father? Did he ever discuss his time serving?
Yeah, no, he didn't talk about it much. In fact, and I think I mentioned in the film, he gave me like anything he had left from the war. He had like a photo album of him and his buddies and boot camp and, you know, in Kaesong, which I took some of these photos on in the trip and I showed them in the movie. He gave me his boots. He gave me his fatigues, his bayonet, his Purple Hearts, everything. And he wanted nothing to do with the war anymore. And the only time I remember him briefly describing the war to me was one thing that we both had in common is that, you know, we both loved to watch these war movies. He liked to watch them as well. So the couple of times that, you know, we would bond is he would take me to go see like if Platoon came out or Full Metal Jacket or whatever. And I would always ask him, you know, was that the way it was? And I'm not sure which film it was. I think it was Hamburger Hill.
If you want to walk out of this place, you will listen to people who know. You be an individual, and I'll be tagging your ugly, toothless face straight on its way to a long box with metal handles.
Strangers. But I asked him, is that more or less what it was like? And he was like, yeah, that was pretty close.
Oh. So you've done a bunch of other coming home films. One of them, Coming Home Haiti, I kind of wanted to ask about something specific to that film, but maybe that has kind of bled into the others. You talked once about when you were filming in Haiti, people told you, put it pretty explicitly, okay, you can film the culture, but like don't film, you know, the areas around that kind of didn't want you to turn into a travelogue of look at the, you know, rundown areas or whatever. And I guess I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that and if that had bled into
future documentary work, this idea of trying, you know, not to turn it into almost kind of an exhibition of, you know, look at how these people are forced to survive.
I mean, that's extremely important to me, to make sure that the people, you know, that we encounter don't feel that we're exploiting them. And I feel that there's plenty of films and series out there that take you on these dangerous, like on purpose, dangerous paths or worlds and show you all these incredible things that are happening around the world so that, you know, that are just sad basically. And I feel there's enough of that. So I'm trying to really show as much as I can, a positive snapshot of and also kind of like analyzing what, you know, culturally what's going on through the music. You know, how has hip hop impacted a place, or, you know, or how hip hop helps us connect with a place. Like it's really, I'm trying to just do something that's a little bit more positive and show these countries in a different light. Now, it doesn't say that if something organic pops up in front of the camera or something happens, we, you know, won't show it in the film. It just all depends in what context.
So moving back to the podcast stuff for a minute, I was watching, you know, some of the clips you put online of the old Sirius show of Crazy Raw Militainment 66 Radio, whatever the title was at that particular point. And there was just sort of one thing in passing that caught my attention is you guys are kind of bantering in the studio and you use the N-word, just, you know, referring to everyone in the crew.
Right.
I think y'all niggas is drinking tiger shit.
And it caught my attention because it was something that hasn't shown up on Drink Champs. And I guess I was just wondering, like, has your relationship to that word changed in the past, you know, 10 years? Has your relationship to using it in public changed? I guess it just sort of, I was surprised to hear you say it.
My relationship to that word has been, it's funny because I would say that probably ever since the day that I heard it and started using the word, I've been grappling with using it. People in Miami in the South can definitely relate that it is a part of our vernacular. Like whether you're Black, Hispanic, white, it's like, I don't know. It's just, and I mean, I'm sure in a lot of other cities, but I can only speak to where I'm from. It's just really a part of our lingo. And it's something that I don't even think about it. And I say it and I use it. But from a young age, I'm talking about from junior high, I've been trying to, I don't know if I've been trying, but I've been struggling with, you know, sometimes I'm like, look, you know, it's just a part of our language, of our lingo. It's a part of what we do. It's not done to harm anybody. And then some days I'm like, I need to stop saying it. But I'll tell you one specific time that made me really think about it was I was in Atlanta and I was pretty young. We went to go do a show out there with my group at that time, the Alliance. And we were in the elevator and this elderly Black woman came into the elevator. And we were just talking crap to each other, me and my friends, a bunch of Spanish dudes and Latinos to be exact. We're saying nigga, we're like, you know, talking crap to each other. And I saw this elderly woman's face. She didn't say anything, but I could only imagine that she for sure was around during the civil rights movement. And she's probably looking at these like Latinos, like throwing around the word. I was like, damn, like, I wonder how that's making her feel. And you know, That had a huge impact on me. Now I'm conflicted because, like I said, I feel like it's a part of, you know, our lingo. It's just a part of like slang, and it's like something that without thinking we, you know, we say down here. But I know that in some situations or depending on your point of view, it's just, you know, it, you could hurt somebody by using that word. I don't know. I'm not going to tell you that I consciously try not to say it, but it's something that since I was young, I've been trying to you know, think about if I should say it or not, you know?
Yeah. You know, one of the things about Drink Champs that's central to it, obviously, is the drinks and sort of the atmosphere that the drinks bring. You've had a couple guests on, just a few, who don't drink.
Mm-hmm.
And does that change the one of them, 50 Cent, you were actually able to convince to drink.
50 took two shots. 50 took two shots for the drink champ.
This is why this drink champ.
This is a fact.
We're trying to bring the truth out.
Bring the truth out.
Drunk facts is what we call it.
Yeah.
Drunk facts.
Let's make some noise for him taking two shots. God damn it.
Hell yeah.
but the ones who kind of don't give in, does that change the mood or the tenor or the of the show at all?
Well, let's be real. I don't think we convinced 50 Cent to drink. I think he came and already knew he was going to drink. I feel that he's such a marketing genius that if he was ever going to drink, he was going to drink his own vodka on Drink Champs. That's what I felt. He came in with that, ready to do that. So sorry, go ahead. What was it that you were asking?
No, just like if someone doesn't drink, does that kind of change the mood of the show at all?
Not really. There's been actually several guests that didn't drink and nobody knew any different, you know? So, you know, we might, depending on who it is and the relationship with us and them or Nori and them, you know, we might try to put some peer pressure on them. But for the most part, really, we're just... as long as we get drunk, that's really going to be it's going to be the same show.
Yeah, definitely. Well, speaking of that, actually, there was at least one show I remember where you kind of
went off the deep end.
Yeah, where you prefaced the show at the beginning by saying, "Oh, well, in this one, I sort of went too far." There have been shows when that happened, when you kind of ended up a little more drunk than you would have liked.
Yeah, I mean, another thing that people don't realize is sometimes we record back to back shows. So imagine if we get drunk in pretty much every episode, and some of these shows run, you know, 2 to 3 hours. Imagine if we do one right after it, which happens often. So,
wow.
So the drunkest episodes, most likely we, you know, that's like the second or third episode of the day that we recorded. Like, for example, Duck Down that we just did in New York recently, we did that after the Ice-T episode. The Dame Dash episode, which famously Nori was a slush, you know, he was at the end.
I like to relax a lot.
But vodka for
us. Well, I mean, I don't know if it's needed, but.
I'll do another one.
You gotta do a shot of vodka. Come on,
at
please.
At the end, we're not done.
I fought with you the whole night. You didn't win.
I said, when we finish, we're not done. If you say we're done, we're done. Say you're done.
No, he's
say
done.
You gotta, it's Dame, this is not your show. You gotta relax. let me
control this. Come on.
I thought he was drinking.
Come on, Gloria, Tito, please. He's been in control too long. Come on, Tito, help me.
He's quitting.
He, you know, we had did the E-40 episode right before that. And
right, E-40, who has his own liquor brand.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the Oskino and Petey Crack episode, which is the one that I even, like, I have this, like fail-safe thing in my personality that says if I feel like I'm getting too drunk, exit stage left, like get the fuck out of Dodge. And that's what I did on that episode. I went to the bathroom and never came back.
If you listen closely right here at about an hour and 25 minutes into the episode, you can hear EFN's chair slide back.
This person. I think it's a good person.
Indeed, he did not return for the rest of the episode.
And that was because we had a block party that we did that day, you know, hosted by the Drink Champs. And usually when we meet, you know, our listeners and our followers, the first thing they want to do with us is take shots. So we were drinking all day with the people at the party, and then we tried to do a show after that.
God. And sometimes your guests kind of get that way too. By the end of the Ja Rule and Jada episode, Ja was noticeably slurring.
Moments.
Hey, listen,
it's old. It don't hurt no more.
Shout out to
Who Cares a Great Guy, my brother.
Who Cares a Great Guy? We got the shit show.
What do you do if you have a guest who's off the rails a little bit? Yeah.
We don't do anything. We just keep recording. You know, we try to protect them if they, you know, from saying or doing anything that is incriminating. Like, for example, on the recent episode with Brand Nubian, Sadat X got pretty nice, and he started to proceed to tell people that if they wanted to fight him, they could go to his meet him at his home, and he started giving his address out. So, you know, we made sure to mute out his address.
My nigga named Vince Staples. He signed a Def Jam or some shit like that. That's what I'm saying.
Songs, I don't even know these
niggas.
Yo.
Niggas want to respond like, to shit that I say.
We'll kill a nigga. Yo, I don't even know what Vince Staples is, yo.
Niggas want to respond to the shit that I say without the intellectual ammunition to fuck with me.
Right.
Oh, man. Yeah, I can imagine some crazy stuff happens.
Just for the record, like, I feel like we're starting to get a reputation of almost like were like setting people up to get drunk. And I feel that that's definitely, I want to let people know that's not the case. You know, everybody that comes on the show is an adult, a grown ass man or woman, and they are going to do what they want to do. And we don't force anybody to do anything. So it's all in good, it's all supposed to be in good fun.
Yeah. And one other episode that, or one moment in an episode that didn't have to do with alcohol, but was seemed a little bit out of control was when you had the phone call where 2 Chainz calls and or you call him and then he starts cursing out one of your guests, starts cursing out Jack Thriller because they had a little, you know, back and forth.
You bugging the fuck out.
Boy, you're a dog, nigga. You're a pussy, nigga, boy. You're a pussy, nigga. Your mama's a pussy, nigga, nigga. If you got anything that you got with blood in it, it's a pussy, nigga. And when you see me, nigga, on sight, pussy-ass nigga. I'm tired of you, pussy-ass nigga.
From the audience perspective, that kind of sounded wild and unexpected. From where you were sitting, what was that moment like?
It was unexpected, and some people thought we set up Jack Thriller, but nobody expected it to go that way at all. And you know, I mean, obviously those type of things go viral and no one's, you know, as long as no one gets hurt, you know, we're not completely mad at it going viral per se, but we really, we, you know, we didn't set it up to go that way. And it was a little awkward when it went down. We were all just like, what are we listening to right now? Like as it was happening, we couldn't.
Right. Because it's someone who literally sounds out of control screaming.
Right. Like he's like, we're just like, what did we step into? What beef do these guys have that we didn't know beforehand?
Right. Right. So business-wise, one of the interesting things that happened is you guys, you know, started out on CBS on their podcast network. And then, you know, a little ways in, there's this partnership with Revolt TV and with Diddy. And, you know, it's a big deal. And you guys have Diddy as a guest. What was it like negotiating with both those companies, kind of starting off with one and then adding the second and trying to make that relationship work for those two parties and for you?
For that specific situation with Revolt, It wasn't anything too complicated. We already had the deal with CBS. We also had a separate video deal with CBS for them to publish our videos through their YouTube page. And so when the Revolt thing came around, you know, we just brought, we actually were very proud that we were able to bring those two entities together to create one deal, which involved all three of us, you know, Drink Champ, CBS, and Revolt. It was a short-term deal with Revolt just to kind of like test out the relationship when it comes to Drink Champs. And now we're in renegotiations for both CBS and Revolt for renewing with them and doing a more in-depth and longer situation. And that was proving a little bit more complicated, but you know, nonetheless, it's all good stuff.
Right. And this is one of the things that you guys kind of didn't know it was going to be so big right out of the gate, right?
Not at all, man.
Yeah, which should have, you know, it's a problem we should all have, but right. I'm sure it caused, you know, some unforeseen things. What were some of the things that sort of surprised you, both maybe business-wise and personally, whatever, about having something like this do so well from episode one?
Well, the first thing that I thought was interesting is, you know, we've all, and I'm sure you guys, you know, all of us, in this business kind of always wonder or speculate like how things go viral. Like did these people pay for views or did they do this or what goes viral? And it was really interesting to be on the inside of something that goes viral, you know, and be like, wow, it really does happen like out of nowhere. Like you just don't know what's going to go viral. And I felt that that's what happened with Drink Champs. And just immediately I'll say this from maybe the first or second episode, we realized that we had something on our hands, but we had, you know, we kind of came into it as like novice, as amateurs, and had a deal like that, which is nobody's fault. So, you know, we just made sure that going into a renewal, you know, we kind of evaluated what we're worth now, seeing how this whole year has gone by, and you know, it's hey, look, I'll just say it like this. Like Biggie said, more money, more problems, right?
Yeah.
And that's definitely what's going on right now.
Sure. Is it odd to have, you've done so much and, you know, you had, you know, we went over last time as a mixtape DJ, you had a clothing store for a while and a marketing company and you released an album about 2 years ago, and all of a sudden, is Drink Champs kind of your main focus right now? Is that more or less your day job these days?
It is one of the main focuses, yeah. It definitely took over a big portion of my attention. I would say it's like 80%, 90% maybe.
And that was not something you were expecting, I'm assuming, when you started out.
Not at all. It was supposed to be, and I'm sure Nori didn't expect it either. Nobody did. It was supposed to be just a little side gig that, look, I'll say it like this. I was asking a lot of podcasters, what should we try to like, in terms of like listenership, how many listeners should we hope to get to at least bring in some kind of revenue, something? And people were telling me, well, if you can get like 60,000 in a couple of weeks on each episode, you could make, you know, a good couple $1,000s a month off of that. And I was like, all right, that's cool. You know, a little extra cash in my, you know, monthly in my pocket doesn't hurt for like to do a podcast, you know, an hour a week. And then the first episode with Fat Joe, I think clocked in at like 400,000 first week. And then it was rising from that point on to where, you know, we're averaging, you know, about 1 million a week.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just really took off and things changed real quickly. And you know, but I will say that everything that I've been doing all these years and everything I've learned, I've put into practice, right? And none of it's, you know, none of it's gone to waste. It's all relevant. And also any other projects I have, just like Nori, when it comes to music or him doing shows, it's all benefiting from the success of Drink Champ.
Yeah, I was going to ask, has it brought, you know, renewed attention to another time, to the album you put out maybe a year before the show started?
It's brought some attention to that, brought a lot more attention to the Coming Home series. You know, there's people that are discovering Mayday when, you know, because I manage them. I feel that, you know, yeah, everything is benefiting from that. And the same thing with Nori. His iTunes sales went up. You know, he's getting more attention when he puts out music right now. He's got more club appearances, more show offers. So, it's benefiting everything all around. Yeah. But it's definitely a balancing act now with how much we put into Drink Champs.
Right. I guess that is something I'm curious about. How did sort of the responsibilities break down? You know, from the fans' perspective, Nori does the vast majority of talking during the actual show.
Right.
But, you know, how do responsibilities sort of break down otherwise between the two of you or between the two of you and your team?
Yeah, I mean, I basically work mostly behind the scenes in terms of organizing the production team, releasing the episodes, getting them, you know, uploaded, edited, out to CBS, you know, coordinating with Revolt. I basically do a lot of that legwork.
Makes sense.
And the marketing of it is pretty much, you know, a lot of my doing. And, you know, obviously Nori is a big part of the marketing just because of who he is. But yeah, I help to organize and coordinate the marketing.
I figured as much, but it's good to have it confirmed. So you in the Diddy episode, it is, you know, comparatively short given how much time you guys actually talked for. Why wasn't the full, you know, 2.5-3 hour conversation released for the masses?
Well, we were just jumping into the Revolt deal with them, and it just, it's such a rambunctious episode.
I did not know. Yeah. Anything I'm gonna say is real. Like, you know, my woman now is you know, that's my woman. That's my number one woman. That's what it is. That's my queen.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm never going to be answering a question like, you know, that's going to be disrespecting anybody.
No,
but ask your question, though, B. You know what I'm saying? Because she, I mean,
taking another shot. How about you loosen up a little bit?
Cassie's a big girl.
Loosen up a little bit.
How you going to tell me?
I didn't know Cassie was here. I'm so sorry, Cassie.
Hey, yo, it's Cassie.
That, you know, they requested that it, you know, that they, well, to be quite fair, because it might sound like we're putting blame on Puff for editing the episode, but really and truly, Revolt and Puff as well, they really didn't understand the format. You know, the podcast format, that it can really be as long as you want it to be. So they kind of edited it down for TV. And, you know, it was after that we kind of had to tell them, no, this is not the way that this should be. This should be, it's really a longer form of content. Kind of got to let it ride out. It's not so structured and edited. So, you know, we kind of you know, spoke about that after the fact. But there's that part of it, and then there's this part that just, it's a crazy episode. It really is. It's a crazy episode, and we, a lot of things happen, and, you know, I don't know if it'll see the light of day, the entire episode. I hope it does one day, because I think it'll be very interesting for people to hear it.
I can imagine. Another very interesting one was DMX, which, again, you know, the lead into it is long. The actual time with X is comparatively short and very interesting. It's almost like, you know, on a tightrope or something, like the sense of precariousness that kind of, as you're listening, seems to be there.
A lot of people don't understand. The top three people at Def Jam had lie in their name.
What?
Oh, I don't know where this is going.
That's a little awkward right there.
Break it down.
It was Lior, which is spelled L-Y or Lior.
Right.
Cohen. Julie, J-U-L-I-E, Lie. Or Kevin Lyles.
Top not going to lie. This thing
top three people.
Let's make some noise.
Top three people.
Everybody make noise. Oh.
What did you get out of that? What is that telling you?
I just told you. The top three people had lie in their name. But this is what bothered me. Because
what was that meeting like from your perspective?
That was a roller coaster also. In the fact that pinning him down to do the podcast. Also, he didn't know what a podcast was. Didn't care what a podcast was. He doesn't really like to do interviews, you know. So, and we had to go to the hotel where he was staying at in Miami. We set up shop in the lobby of the hotel. I asked the people, you know, the people who worked at the front desk to turn. They had like music in the lobby. I had, please turn it. Like, we deboed the whole lobby. And imagine if you're someone staying in that hotel and you walk out to like Drink Champs in the lobby with DMX. Like, that must have been insane. And we, there was an issue that doesn't, you know, we don't talk about on the episode, that our regular engineer, Hazardous Sounds, he wasn't able to be there that day. So we had to bring in a backup engineer, and he had to format his computer to work with our preamp. And he had to do it there using the Wi-Fi in the lobby of the hotel. So I'm sure you could understand the Wi-Fi wasn't the best. And it took forever for him to download the plugins and all that. It took like, I think it took like damn near 2 hours. And we're trying to hold off DMX, who's not that sure that he wants to do the podcast with us. So we're trying to keep him at bay, like, no, please stick around. We promise. We're about to start.
For 2 hours.
Right. And he's like,
amazing.
He's like in the pool area with Nori, like drinking Hennessy. And imagine for 2 hours. So that's why you get what you got and how you got it, because of that backstory of us trying to get everything together and get it ready.
Amazing. So are there Drink Champs related projects in the works beyond the actual show?
Other than, you know, merchandising and stuff like that. And we're also trying to roll out a network, like where we're kind of like a, you know, like an imprint record label where we put out artists, but we put out podcasts instead. That's something that we're really, you know, passionate about trying to do and roll out, which we're hoping to do in the next month or so, which would be the Drink Champs podcast network. And then we'll put out other podcasts. But other than that, that's pretty much it for now.
Okay. And, you know, I have to ask one very particular thing. You guys have an intro to the show where you, same every week, you guys introduce yourselves. And Nori has a catchphrase that he also used on the radio show.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have listened to it, you know, dozens of times at this point, if not more, and cannot make out what it is.
Hey, hang, sangria, this your boy.
What is that?
He says, hang, hang, sangria, that one?
Yes, that one.
Yeah.
Slow it down and say what it is.
Yeah. Hang, hang, I don't think there's any specific meaning to hang, hang. Like, maybe just, like, making a noise. Like, hang, hang, like, what's up? Like, hey, hey, like that. And then sangria is a Spanish, you know, like, fruit wine.
Right, sangria. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there was one time where Nori's, like, really into sangria. I think he was going to put out his... Actually, he was going to put out his own brand called Hang, Hang, Sangria, to be honest. So it's just one of... It's a Noriism. You know, Nori has a lot of Noriism. But I want people to know that we say Makahaya Bing Bong on the show.
Makahaya Bing Bong.
That is my ism. Like, I've been saying Makahaya Bing Bong since I was a kid watching all these war movies, because I thought I was always trying to like learn Vietnamese by like saying whatever they said. And I thought they were saying Makahaya Bing Bong at one point, and I would always say that.
And, you know, Nori obviously is famous for refusing to Google anything about his guests.
I told y'all I'm not interviewing nobody if I got to Google them. If I got to Google you, you will not make it. Because, you know, we're going to drop our podcast every Friday. So labels switch their release date to Fridays. So I just want to be clear. If you want me to get your artist on here, we got to know who the fuck they are.
But to be fair, he's often known them 10, 15, 20 years. So, the amount of Googling he would have to do anyway is probably pretty limited. What kind of prep, research work, whatever, do you do going into each episode for your specifically relating to the guests?
I don't do any research. I really feel strongly about our show. Not, you know, I feel like there's plenty of shows, really good shows like you guys that are true journalists and you know, come in with researched, you know, topics and have those kind of conversations, those intellectual type of conversations where you dig deep. I feel that, you know, although you're going to get some stuff from our show, some, you know, like behind the scenes or history, I really, you know, stick to the whole thing where we're just having a conversation, organic conversation. And I go off of, you know, what I already know about someone. And if I don't know, I try to learn right there on the spot.
Okay. And one thing we did not talk about when going through your past last time was your DJ name. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I told people that I'd be talking to you and they wanted to know where it came from. And, you know, to spoil the surprise, it's your initials.
Yes.
But what is sort of the weirdest thing people thought your DJ name came from?
There's never been anything weird that someone said. Well, there's been jokes more than anything weird. Like, my friends, you know, like I have a friend of mine. I'm a godfather to three of his kids, and you know, I'm really good when it comes to children. So one of my friends started calling me everybody's favorite nanny. and another friend of mine's like, everybody, what did he say? Oh no, he said Eric's fucking nice was another one that one of my friends would say. But no one's ever said anything weird. The only thing that always annoyed me is that people would pronounce it effin versus saying EFN. And
then think it had something to do with the vodka.
Well, now they do, but before they would just say effin and people would be like I remember there was this one group of people from Complex Media. I used to do a, you know, I have my marketing company and I was doing something for them during the Echo days.
Clothing designer Mark Echo started Complex Magazine, which eventually turned into Complex Media back in 2002. Incidentally, Sean is now a senior news editor at Complex.
And I remember this group was just the whole weekend I was rolling when they're like, effing Jesus. And they knew it bugged me. And they're like, effing Jesus. And so that's just, I don't know. I know that I'm just going to have to deal with that for the rest of my life, unless I put dots on the EFN, which I'm not going to. But yeah, no, that's not really weird. I mean, it's better than my previous names that I had. My first name was DJ E-Funk. And then I went to Funk E, like I thought that was any better.
Like Funk dash the letter E?
Yeah. And then I was like, let me just keep it simple and keep it, you know, very simple. And I just made it my initials.
Nice. So, you know, obviously Drink Champs, like you said, is taking up, you know, 80-90% of your time. But what else is going on right now for you?
I'm also working with a liquor brand that I'm part owner of the brand. It's called Colombian White. It's an aguardiente, which is, it's funny that, you know, and I don't know if we actually talked, well, we haven't talked about this yet, but I'm about to go on my next coming home trip, which is Colombia this weekend. So I'm really excited about being involved in that brand, and not just because I'm going to Colombia, but I'm just excited to be involved in this brand. It's made in Miami. It's distilled here locally. I have two business partners that are Colombian that, you know, made their own recipe of aguardiente. I don't know if you're familiar with aguardiente, but it's kind of like a very popular drink in Colombia. Two Colombians, they usually take it in shots, but we're trying to change the nature of it where people drink it in cocktails. And it's kind of like the process right before rum. So it's kind of like related to a rum, but it doesn't taste necessarily like rum. So that's something that I'm doing. We got the next coming home. Like I said, we're embarking. We're going to Colombia this weekend. And I'm going to continue the Coming Home series. It's something that I'm super passionate about. I have other film ideas and documentaries that I want to do that hopefully I can, you know, work on soon. And I am planning on doing new music. I wanted to get something out in 2016, but because of Drink Champs, it was a little difficult to do that. So look out for hopefully an EP, and you know, and then maybe before the half, you know, before we get to the halfway mark of the year, I should have at least an EP out.
Nice. And what's going on with our friends in Mayday?
Mayday's doing amazing, man. They just came off tour with this group, this band, better said, called Common Kings. We've been putting Mayday out on the road with different kinds of artists to broaden their fan base and their audience, and they've been loving it, you know, just touching and meeting different kinds of people out there. And they're working on a new album. Recognize has got a new solo album about to come out. So just a lot of music from the guys. They're going to continue to tour. Recognize will be on some spot dates on the new Tech N9ne tour that's coming soon. And just new music from the guys.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And best of luck with everything. Congratulations on the success of Drink Champs.
No, thank you, guys. And also congratulations to you guys, man. I love what you guys do. And I follow you guys and check out, you know, as many interviews as I can. And you guys do a great job.
Thank you. So much has happened with DJ EFN since the last time we talked, including, of course, the creation of Drink Champs. I'm pretty sure we're the only people who are going to give you the full decade-long story behind that podcast creation, the true meaning of Nori's catchphrases, and a first-hand account of what Tiger Bone really tastes like. As an aside, if this is your first time listening to The Cypher, this is the kind of insight we get out of all of our guests. It was also very moving to hear about the creation of Coming Home Vietnam and how personal the project was for EFN. Veterans coming home from wars, especially the generation that fought in Vietnam, were often changed forever by the experience and rarely spoke about it. Talking to EFN about his relationship with his father and his father's relationship with the war helped me understand just how personal the project of making Coming Home Vietnam was. Returning to the base his father served at as a way of understanding him is one of the highlights of the film and of our interview as well. Join us next week when we talk to Martin Connor. Martin is the mind behind the website Rap Analysis, and he brings a composer's trained ear to hip-hop. I've long been a huge fan of his writing, and I'm thrilled to be able to bring you his ideas, which will give you the tools to listen to hip-hop in a whole new way. And then join us the week after to check our interview with the noted producer and engineer Skef Ansem. Skef has worked with De La Soul, Brand Nubian, and tons more, including, of course, A Tribe Called Quest.
No shit, Skef Ansem, he gets props too.
Even if you haven't heard of Skef, all of your favorite producers cite him as one of their influences. Make sure to listen to find out why. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, you should listen to our first talk with DJ EFN on episode 102. If you use iTunes, it's incredibly important to give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. Also, consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making this show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. Become a patron by the end of April to get access to May's file. In case you didn't know, the bonus material for May is a pre-Son of Berserk version of the track Fresh from the Back of the N41, which was recorded as a promo for Bill Stefni's Mr. Bill show at Adelphi University. It dates from the mid-1980s, it's over 8 minutes long, and it features a pre-Public Enemy Chuck D. Oh, and it doesn't exist anywhere but here, since Bill gave it directly to us. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com.
The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I don't do any research.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
As long as we get drunk, that's really going to be the same show.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
The Chinese felt that had some healing and magical properties.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Nothing to be proud about, but it's just what we do.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Justin Scott Weeks.
It's 50 cents a drink.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Yeah, I did a show out there one time in Mexicali with Pitbull, and you know, it was we were good.